All right, good morning. This is Bio 241. It's Thursday, the 15th of January, our second meeting. We're going to finish up chapter one, move on to chapter two, which is chemistry today. But before we get started, I got a couple things to say. One thing is, I've had a number of emails from students saying that when they tried to open up the PowerPoint slides in Blackboard, they would just get a blank page. It would just come up as a blank page. And I've tried that with a number of internet browsers, and they all seem to be working the same way. If you just say open, Blackboard has developed a problem to where it cannot open a PowerPoint file in the frame, on the right-hand side frame. So what you have to do is save the PowerPoint file to your hard drive, and then you will be able to open it up. So right-click, save target as, save it to your computer, and then you'll have access to those PowerPoints. But it won't open up. PowerPoints won't open up within Blackboard. Maybe your computer does, but I haven't found one yet, so it might be a ubiquitous problem. Microsoft Word opens up in the Blackboard frame just fine, but PowerPoint doesn't. So save target as, save it as a file, and then open it up as an independent file outside of Blackboard. And it should work okay for you. And then you can print it out. Okay. All right, another message is that Juan wants to say hi again.
Real quick, for all you guys that didn't receive my email, I believe 2 days ago, I went ahead and got a room, CUS 316, and for all you guys that don't know where that is, if you go west on campus towards the bookstore, past the bookstore, that tall building right there, third floor, room 316, I'll be there at 1:30. So, hope to see you there.
So that's today, SI today. Right, okay. All right, thank you, Juan. All right, so let's finish up with some concepts in chapter one. We talked about experimental method last time. What's the reason for experimental method? Why should we go through all that trouble of trying to understand something or prove something through experimental method as opposed to maybe some other method? What's to prove a hypothesis? Okay, I like that, to prove a hypothesis, because a hypothesis is just a guess, right? And when you prove a hypothesis, what kind of information do you get?
Theory.
Okay, yeah, you get a theory. So a theory has much more importance associated to it compared to a hypothesis. Okay, another way that I think about the reason why we put up with experimental method and do all the statistics and experimental group and control group is because we want reliable information. Okay, so when you prove a hypothesis, you get reliable information. The outcome of using the scientific method is to gain reliable information that you can count on, that you can bet your life on, right? So that's the importance of the scientific method. And all the information that's in your book is the result of using that scientific method. So there are no hypotheses in your textbook. They're all theories, unless it's clearly stated that it's a hypothesis or conjecture. But all that information in your book is not made up by me or by anybody else. It's been worked out through scientific method. And that means a lot of work, and a lot of people check these ideas out to make sure that they were true and accurate. Okay, what's another important concept in chapter one that we were talking about? Yeah, homeostasis. So what does homeostasis mean to you? Did we talk enough about it yet for you to get an idea what homeostasis is? I think we're kind of in the middle, so maybe not, but yeah. Okay, a state of... Yeah, I like that, relative state of constancy. Oh yeah, the concept of regulation is very important, because our internal environment is a lot different than the outside world, because our internal environment is alive and the outside environment isn't. Right? So our body temperature is not room temperature, thank God. Right? If it were, then we would be dead. Okay, anybody else have an idea about homeostasis? I think we need to talk a little bit more about it. I didn't show you all the slides on homeostasis. But somebody said relative constancy. This is a real important concept for homeostasis. Homeostasis doesn't mean that the parameters, the physiologic parameters inside your body, like pH and temperature and blood pressure and glucose concentration in the blood, It doesn't mean that all these things are absolutely constant. It means that they can change a little bit, right? They can fluctuate, and that a fluctuation in one parameter compensates for a fluctuation in another parameter, and all of these things compensate each other so that nothing changes a lot. So everything can change a little bit so that nothing changes a lot. Okay, so let me build up on that concept a little bit. So that's where they come up with this term dynamic constancy. It seems like there's two terms right here that don't make sense, because one term, dynamic, means change, and constancy means no change. So how can we put these, why do we put these two concepts together? The dynamic means that the change is small, but change is taking place all the time in your body, but these changes are very, very small. All right, and what happens then is that the change is constant because the change never gets big. So what is constant is this normal range of values. Say this could be maybe your body temperature or blood pressure or something. What would be a normal body temperature for somebody to have? Yeah, like 98.6. That's just a single number. But as you start to exercise, your body temperature is going to increase a little bit, and that's okay. If it increases just a little bit right here, all right, then there's going to be other things taking place in your body to bring it back down. And over a short period of time, your body temperature is going to go back down again, and when it becomes less than 98.6, right, there'll be other mechanisms to increase your body temperature back to 98.6, and that 98.6 is what we call the set point. And as long as your body temperature doesn't go beyond this normal range right here, you're in a state of health. All right, so that's where the dynamic term comes from in dynamic constancy. Things can fluctuate a little bit. The constancy means that it can't deviate beyond this normal range of values. That's what dynamic constancy means. And the way that your body maintains homeostasis, or this dynamic constancy, is through the employment of negative feedback loops. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about some negative feedback loops as well. Okay, so here is the illustration that is in your textbook, and it outlines the items that make up a response loop. All right, so here we have a physiologic parameter, and this could be blood pressure or it could be temperature, for instance. And at this point in time, we're going to increase this variable right here, maybe increase temperature or increase blood pressure. So in order for you, and let's just pick temperature. So in order for your body to notice that your temperature is increasing right at this point in time, what does your body have to have? Yeah, it's got to have a thermometer in there someplace. There's got to be a sensor, right? If you have, how do you appreciate light? What do you need for light? What do you need in order for you to see something? Yeah, you need a retina, right? And if you don't have a retina, you can't see light, right? Then you're blind. The same thing for any other modality of energy. If your body's going to compensate and adjust your body temperature, there has to be a sensor that is operating that can monitor temperature. And for instance, if your body is going to adjust your blood pressure, what does it have to have before it can adjust your blood pressure? There's got to be a little meter someplace in your body that measures blood pressure. Otherwise, no place in your body will know what the pressure is of your blood. Anybody know what those receptors are called for blood pressure? The pressure receptors. We talk about that in lab. Some of you probably didn't go to lab yet this week. But they're called baroreceptors, right? Like barometer is something you would look at home to measure the pressure in the air to figure out what's going to happen, if it's going to be a nice day or a rainy day. All right, so those are all sensors or receptors. So there has to be a thermal receptor to monitor a change in body temperature, an increase in body temperature, and then this sensor has to send that information to the integration center. This is what we typically call an afferent pathway. It can be a nerve that goes from wherever the sensor is to the integration center. The integration center is usually in the brain someplace, usually like the medulla oblongata or maybe the hypothalamus. And in the integration center, there is the absolute normal value that your body should be operating at. And that's what we call the set point. We saw that on the previous slide. So the set point is found in the integration center. The job of the integration center is to receive the information from the sensor, compare it to the set point, all right, and then it has to make a decision. So if the set point in the integration center is equal to the information that it's getting from the sensor, for instance, maybe the sensor is sending body temperature and it's saying the body temperature is 98.6 and the set point is 98.6, what's the decision that the integration center has to make? Okay, it's happy. It doesn't really have to make any change because your body is exactly at normal temperature. So that's the decision. Okay, but let's just say that the sensor is picking up information that says your body temperature is 90 degrees instead of 98.6. The integration center says that there is an error between the set point and what your body temperature actually is, and then what should this integration center do? It better do what? Figure out a way to increase your body temperature and send signals maybe to your skeletal muscles to start you to shiver or something, to generate heat in your body. So it's going to send information out nerve fibers, which would be the efferent pathway, to an effector organ. In that particular case, when you start to shiver, what's the effector organ? It's going to be a muscle someplace or a number of muscles that's going to increase your body temperature, and then that's what we call a response. So an effector produces a response that brings, oh, I went the other way, okay. All right, I'll do it again, which then brings your body temperature back up. Well, let's stay with this with this particular diagram. So X is going to be body temperature. Maybe you start exercising. And what happens to your body temperature as you start to exercise? It increases, right? That's picked up by the sensor, sends information to the integration center. Integration center says, oh, your body temperature is 100 degrees, but it should only be 98. It's going to say to maybe a sweat gland right here. The sweat gland is going to be an effector, and you're going to start sweating, and that perspiration is going to cool your body down. All right, so the effector produces a response which brings your temperature back down. So is your body temperature constant? In this particular example, it goes up and it comes down. All right, so that means the dynamic part of homeostasis, but the constancy part is what? Your body temperature doesn't go beyond this normal range of temperature. So it doesn't. If it went beyond, that would be a disease state. Okay, and indeed, these disease states can be fatal. Like hyperthermia can be fatal. Hypothermia can be fatal. So homeostasis maintains body temperature and other parameters, physiologic parameters in your body within a range that's suitable to support life. Okay, so here is X. Is X constant over time? What can you tell me? Is X constant? So here it's the same, here it's the same, here it's the same. Well, oh, what about in this region right here? What's happening to X? It's going up. So that means what? It is changing, right? This physiologic parameter is changing, and then what happens to it? It starts to go back down. All right, so homeostasis maintains X within a range that's suitable to support life, but it doesn't maintain it absolutely flat like that. That's where that dynamic constancy came from. Okay, so is X constant over time? You would say, no, it varies a little bit. It changes a little bit, right, but not a lot. That's what homeostasis does. All right, so here is a really nice illustration of that response loop or any kind of response loop. And this one, you should just burn into your memory. This is a really good one to know. Okay, so a response loop always starts with a stimulus, which is some change in a particular parameter inside your body. And in order for your body to appreciate this stimulus, what does it have to have? It's got to have a sensor or a receptor. That receptor has to send information to the integration center. That's what we call the afferent pathway. And that signal goes to the integration center. What does this integration center have? It's got the set point. That's right. So it can compare this incoming information with the set point. It will analyze that information and make a decision what to do. And if the set point is equal to the information coming from the receptor, the integration center doesn't have to do anything. But if there's a difference, it has to send information out through an efferent pathway to an effector, which produces a response. Either it's going to be an increase or decrease of that same energy, for that same modality that the stimulus is. It could be temperature or whatever. Okay, so this response will feed back to the stimulus right here. So let's just say if the stimulus was an increase in body temperature, if it's going to maintain homeostasis, the response is going to produce a decrease in body temperature. Just like what we saw here, the stimulus is an increase, the response is a decrease in body temperature. Okay, so now let's look at the relationship between the response and the stimulus. In this particular case, right, as body temperature goes down, is that in the same direction as the stimulus, or is it an opposite direction? It's opposite direction, right? So if the response subtracts from the stimulus, right, if it produces an opposite direction from the stimulus, we call that negative feedback. So if the response subtracts from the stimulus, we call that negative feedback. If the response adds to the stimulus, we call that positive feedback. So that's where those terms came from. All right, so if we go back and look at this example right here, we see that this body temperature, for instance, is going back down. This response is subtracting from the stimulus. That's negative feedback. So is that a good thing or is that typically a bad thing? The negative feedback is actually the proper and good kind of feedback to be employed because it's going to maintain homeostasis by keeping this parameter within this normal range of values that's suitable to support life. All right, but if it's positive feedback, what would happen? As body temperature increases, what would happen to body temperature if it's positive feedback? Where the response added to the stimulus, body temperature would increase. And then what would happen? It would increase even more. And then what would happen? It would increase even more, right? It would continue to go up until what happened? Until you burst into flames and burn up. Okay. Well, that wouldn't really happen, right? That's a physical impossibility, but you would die nonetheless, right, via hyperthermia. Okay. So that would be a disease state. So positive feedback mechanisms usually produce disease states. Negative feedback mechanisms produce healthy, disease-free states. Okay. So in this response loop right here, a response loop always begins with what? What does a response loop always start with? Stimulus, right? Some change from normal value, and a response loop always ends with a response. And then you have to appreciate the relationship between the response and the stimulus to know if it's positive feedback or negative feedback. Okay. And which one produces homeostasis and a healthy state? Which kind of feedback? Negative feedback, right? Negative feedback is the good kind of feedback to have. All right, so negative feedback is any kind of body mechanism by which any change from an ideal normal value is made smaller or resisted. Negative feedback leads to a compensated healthy state and maintains homeostasis. And with negative feedback, the response subtracts from the stimulus. That's why we call it negative feedback. Even though it's good, it's negative feedback. Positive feedback, on the other hand, is a body mechanism by which any change from an ideal normal value is made greater. If your body temperature goes up, it would make your body temperature go up even more. Positive feedback leads to a decompensated disease state, away from homeostasis. That response adds to the stimulus, moving the system away from the set point. Okay. All right, some other ways to look at homeostasis is that the regulatory control mechanisms can either be intrinsic or they can be extrinsic. There are two different ways. Intrinsic just means that the control is built into the organ that is being regulated. It doesn't need an integration center in the brain, and it doesn't need nerves to send signals, say, from the blood to the brain and then back to an organ. The organ itself has the ability to compensate for changes inside the body, And a really good example of this is the Frank Starling Law of the Heart, which we'll talk about when we get into the cardiac chapter in about 3 months or so. But the Frank Starling Law of the Heart just says that as the heart fills up with blood, when the heart is relaxed, blood flows back to the heart, and it fills up with blood, the heart stretches a little bit. And the more blood that flows back to the heart stretches even more. And the stretching of the heart produces or enables the heart to contract with more force. So if there's a little bit of blood going back to the heart contracts very weakly. And that makes sense because there's only a little bit of blood in the heart. Right? And as the heart fills up with more and more blood, the heart gets stronger. It contracts with more force. And again, that sort of makes sense because as more blood comes back to the heart, it should contract with more vigor to pump that blood out to maintain your body temperature. All right? And we'll see that there are just some proteins inside the heart that will allow that to happen. Okay, we call that the Frank Starling Law of the Heart. Doesn't require any nerves or hormones or central nervous system or anything. It's just a property of the heart muscle itself. So the heart gets stronger as it stretches. Okay, an extrinsic mechanism means that the control comes from outside the organ that is being regulated. For instance, body temperature is controlled by antagonistic effects of sweating and shivering. So, for instance, if your body temperature decreases, there are thermoreceptors that send information to the integration center in the brain, and the brain then is going to send information to skeletal muscles to contract or to shiver. That's going to produce heat. Your body temperature increases. All right, so there's a whole nice response loop right here with nerves and muscles. And then when you get too hot, these muscles are going to stop contracting and something else is going to happen. Not a muscle is going to be stimulated, but a sweat gland is going to be stimulated to secrete perspiration that will cool your body down. All right, so this is an example of extrinsic control because we need different organs and different parts of your body to control your body temperature. Okay, so what type of feedback is operating in the above example? Yeah, because we see that your body temperature is, number one, not absolutely constant, but it's still healthy because it doesn't go beyond this normal range of values, right? So that's where that concept of dynamic constancy comes from. All right. Here's another example of extrinsic control. When we look at the concentration of glucose in our blood, so here is a plot of glucose concentration in milligrams per deciliter, that's just a concentration, versus time. All right. Our blood glucose concentration should be fairly constant. So for instance, regardless if we're in a fed state or fasted state, our blood glucose should be fairly constant. We'll see how that is managed in the last slide right here. But we can disturb this normal control by injecting a normal person with insulin. And insulin is a hormone. Insulin allows all the cells in your body to absorb glucose. So insulin is, like for instance, if you travel someplace, like if you go to, who went someplace over Christmas holidays? Cool. Where did you go?
Yosemite.
Okay. That's a really cool place. All right. But I'm thinking someplace a lot farther away. Did anybody go like to Jakarta or something like that? Anybody go to Hong Kong? No? Well, let's pretend you did. Okay. And what would you need to go to these places before you would get let into these countries? You would need a passport. Okay, you would need a passport. I'm not quite sure I heard what everybody said, but a passport in order before that government would allow you entry into that country. Okay? Well, the same thing for glucose. In most cells in your body, okay, it needs a passport to get in. Glucose just doesn't enter cells, and that passport is insulin. Right? And without insulin in your body, glucose can't enter cells. And that's really bad because cells need glucose. Cells will starve to death without glucose. So that's why you need to have good insulin in your body. All right, but let's just play around with this individual who has normal blood glucose. Let's give them a shot of insulin That's a passport to allow glucose to enter cells. So what's going to happen to blood glucose concentration if we give somebody an insulin shot?
Down.
It's going to decrease because it's going to leave the blood and go into cells. All right, so that's what this shows right here. Blood glucose is going to drop. All right, but is that a normal situation or abnormal? Abnormal, that's a perturbation, right? So now the glucose concentration is way below the set point. And what is your body going to do? It's going to invoke some mechanisms to bring your blood glucose level back up to where it should be right here. And that's going to involve the pancreas and the liver and a number of organs besides the blood. And because the blood isn't regulating glucose right here, it's the liver and the pancreas, okay, we call that extrinsic control because it requires many other organs besides the blood to regulate blood glucose concentration. All right, so right here, as we see blood glucose concentration going back to normal, what kind of feedback is operating in the above example? Okay, that's negative feedback. That's right. Okay, negative feedback. This right here, this initial injection of insulin, that's really not part of any kind of feedback loop. That's just changing the internal environment. That's really the stimulus. Right, so the stimulus is a decrease in blood glucose. The response is an increase in blood glucose. And when the stimulus and response subtract from each other or go in opposite directions, that's a result of negative feedback. Right? Okay. And that's extrinsic control. Every once in a while, you're going to run into maybe 4 or 5 cases where positive feedback is used in a normal situation. Right? There are not very many circumstances where positive feedback operates in a normal everyday circumstance to maintain health, but there are a couple. And you should probably be aware of these. And the first one is in the production of blood clots. Positive feedback mechanisms can operate very quickly. They're very fast. So, for instance, if you cut yourself, would you like to stop bleeding in a day or two or like right away? Right away. Right? So there are some positive feedback mechanisms that quickly cause a blood clot to form at that site where the injury to that blood vessel is so that it plugs up. All right, but it's only in that one little area where the injury is. It's not all over your body. Okay, that's a result of positive feedback mechanism. Maybe we'll see that when we get to the blood chapter. Another one, okay, has to do with ovulation. All right, so this is a part of our reproductive cycle, and eggs develop inside an ovary, but in order for fertilization to take place, these mature eggs have to leave an ovary and go into a fallopian tube. And that process of an egg leaving an ovary going into a fallopian tube is what we call ovulation. And there's a hormone that causes that to happen, and it's called luteinizing hormone. And this happens right at mid-cycle. Luteinizing hormone increases, which causes a change in the ovary, which causes more luteinizing hormone to be produced, which causes that same change in the ovary, which causes more LH to be released, which causes further changes in the ovary, which causes more LH to take place. And you might be wondering, well, how come the whole world isn't just filled up with LH if the ovary is causing LH to increase and the increase in LH is causing the ovary to secrete compounds to increase LH even more? Well, what happens? Yeah, you ovulate. Something kind of catastrophic happens. It's not a bad thing. Ovulation is a nice, normal thing. But it's something that changes that egg and ovary forever, right? And then that positive feedback cycle is stopped right after ovulation. Okay. Another thing is parturition is also a positive feedback mechanism. And for instance, that's due to a hormone called oxytocin. And parturition is controlled pretty much by the fetus. So, for instance, when a fetus is really, really small in utero, it has a lot of room around in there to play soccer or whatever they do, I'm not sure, okay, when a fetus is really, really small. But near term, when it's time for delivery, what happens to the fetus? It's really big. Does it have room to turn around, play soccer anymore? It's confined. Okay, and when you confine an individual, their level of stress increases, okay, because they're confined. And so the fetus releases stress hormones. The mother's body can sense those stress hormones and then releases oxytocin as a result of that. Oxytocin causes contraction of smooth muscle. So what happens to the uterus? The uterus is smooth muscle. You probably should know that from anatomy. So the uterus contracts a little bit. What happens to the fetus? Does that cause the fetus to relax or increase stress? Increases stress. All right, so the fetus increases stress hormones, which causes an increase in oxytocin, which causes the uterus to contract more, which causes more stress, right, which causes more oxytocin to be released, which causes the uterus to contract even more, which causes more oxytocin, which causes more contraction. And so then what happens? Well, baby comes out, right, as a result of that. Okay, so that's what stops that positive feedback mechanism. So that's a very important positive feedback mechanism as well. One more would be the milk letdown reflex. I don't know if any of you have ever nursed any infants, for instance, but this is another really good example. The breast has smooth muscle that contracts, that expels milk from the breast, and again, oxytocin stimulates that muscle to contract, which then causes milk letdown. So for instance, when an infant starts to nurse, okay, and starts to suckle on a nipple, there are nerve receptors on a nipple which sends information to the mother's brain, which then releases oxytocin into the circulation, which causes contraction of the glandular tissue of the breast, produces milk letdown. So what happens to the infant then when there is milk there to nourish itself? Does it become disinterested or? It starts nursing, right? It starts suckling because there's a product there, there's nutrition there. Okay, and so the mother's brain realizes that, releases more oxytocin, which causes more milk letdown. Okay, which causes more suckling, which causes more milk letdown. And then you might be asking, well, if suckling produces more milk letdown, which produces more suckling, which produces more milk letdown, how come our world is not just completely filled up with breast milk? And that's because the breast just has a finite capacity to produce milk, right? And then when the breast is devoid of milk, what happens to the infant? Becomes disinterested, falls asleep, right? And so that's how that positive feedback cycle gets reset, okay? So positive feedback is useful in some circumstances, but not generally in the body. Okay, so here is another example of homeostasis in a feedback loop. And in this particular case, I think you looked at this in lab, or will look at this one in lab, in particular in terms of blood pressure. All right, so your blood pressure is maintained by a couple of different mechanisms that we'll look at. Generally speaking, we can break them down into long-term mechanisms or short-term. And for short-term control of blood pressure, this is the mechanism that is used. Long-term is through some hormonal kinds of reflexes, right, which are long-term, slower to operate. But this is fast, all right, or short-term. So when a person is lying down and they stand up, all right, their blood pressure is going to drop in everybody. Your blood pressure drops, and if you can't compensate for that decrease, so that would be a stimulus, a decrease in blood pressure is a stimulus, and if your body can't compensate for that decrease in blood pressure, what might happen to you? You might not have enough blood pressure to force blood up to your brain. What's going to happen to your brain then? You're going to pass out, right? You might actually get a little woozy or kind of get a little blackout, but you might actually pass out. And what kind of circumstance is that? Yeah, that's called syncope, and it's really dangerous, right? That's called fainting or syncope. Because if you faint, well, for instance, if I were to faint, you know, I'd hit my head on the podium here and bounce off that, and then hit the table, and my head would bounce off that, and then it would hit the floor and bounce off that. And, you know, that could make a really big mess. Right, so fainting is not good. So how does your body prevent you from fainting? So the stimulus is a decrease in blood pressure when you change body position, like getting up in the morning first thing. Okay. So in order for your body to measure this decrease in blood pressure or stimulus, what do you have to have? you've got to have a pressure sensor someplace in your body, and you do. In the arch of the aorta and the carotid sinus up over here, there are those things called baroreceptors that measure blood pressure. Right? And so they're stimulated, and then they send signals to the integration center, which is in the medulla oblongata, namely the cardioregulatory center. These nerves are different depending on if they're coming from the arch of the aorta or the baroreceptors in the carotid sinus. It's either part of the vagus or the glossopharyngeal nerve. So this would be the afferent pathway. The integration center has got to have the, what is it, integration? The set point, which is your normal blood pressure. So it's going to compare your actual blood pressure with the set point and then make a decision. So in this particular case, your blood pressure is too low. The integration center is going to go, in one case, it can go to a number of different places, but on this diagram we have the heart right here. How can your heart increase blood pressure? Might you guess? What might your heart do to increase your blood pressure that's falling? It can beat faster, right? So it might increase heart rate, but it can do something else. It can not only beat faster, it can beat stronger, right? It can increase force of contraction, two things on the heart. And as the force of contraction increases and the heart rate increases, that increases your blood pressure. We have a rise in blood pressure. And how does that correspond to the stimulus? Does it add to it or subtract from it? It subtracts from it. So, right, we call that a nice negative feedback response, and your blood pressure is back to normal and you don't pass out, which is a really good thing. Okay. So this is how homeostasis works. I got these two examples right here, and that's it for this chapter. Let's look at a response loop that involves a hormone, okay, or a couple hormones. And let's look at how glucose is regulated in your blood. You probably know a little bit about this. So for instance, when you're in a fed state, for instance, when you're eating, your body is absorbing glucose from the food that you eat. All right, so glucose enters your GI tract, and then it's absorbed into your circulatory system, into your bloodstream. So glucose is increasing when you're eating. All right, so blood glucose increases. So what's that? This is making your blood glucose go above maybe what it should be. That's what we call a stimulus. All right, there has to be a receptor to monitor that stimulus, and indeed there are cells inside the pancreas that have glucose receptors. And they see blood glucose increasing above a set point, so they make a decision to bring glucose back down by releasing insulin into the blood. And what is insulin again? What's every common day word I used for insulin? Okay, it's a passport. It allows glucose to enter cells, and glucose can only enter cells if insulin is there. If insulin's not there, glucose is stuck in the blood and can't go anywhere. Okay. All right, so insulin then is released from the pancreas. It allows glucose to enter cells. So what happens to blood levels of glucose when it goes from the blood into cells? It goes down, right? Okay. And so this is the response, a decrease in blood glucose. And what can you tell me about the relationship between the stimulus and the response right here? They add to each other or subtract? They subtract, right? So that's a nice negative feedback loop maintaining homeostasis. So that's what happens when glucose increases. Let's go the other way, all right? When you're in a fasted state, when you're not eating anything, like maybe when you first wake up in the morning, you haven't eaten anything. Hi. The integration center is inside the pancreas right here. Okay, those cells contain receptors, and then automatically there are molecular mechanisms that make a decision to release insulin. And we're going to see how that is in a couple chapters, how that works. Okay. And there's a couple different kinds. What is this disease process called when somebody can't regulate their own insulin or has trouble, better way of saying that, has trouble regulating their blood glucose? What do we call that? Yeah, diabetes mellitus. There are different kinds of diabetes. There's diabetes insipidus, diabetes mellitus, and there's different kinds of diabetes mellitus that we're going to look at too. Okay. So let's look at when somebody is in the opposite state compared to the fed state. When somebody's not in the fed state, we say they're in the fasting state. They're not absorbing glucose because there's nothing in their GI tract to be absorbed into the blood. All right, so that's going to cause blood glucose to decrease. But don't forget, in order to make ourselves healthy and keep our brain and heart functioning, blood glucose should be within a normal range of values. And again, it's the pancreas that has glucose receptors that can monitor blood glucose. And in this particular case, as blood glucose decreases, you think the pancreas should release insulin, as over here. No, the opposite should happen. A decrease in secretion of insulin, and there is a second hormone called glucagon. Right? The effects of insulin and glucagon are opposite or antagonistic to each other. And glucagon is released into the blood. It goes to the liver. And the liver has a compound in it called glycogen. And glycogen is a storage form of glucose. Glycogen has thousands or maybe even millions of molecules of glucose just all added together. And when the liver gets a signal, the glycogen signal from the pancreas, it's going to chop off a glucose molecule and put it in the blood. Okay? And then if that's, and what is that going to do? That's going to increase glucose concentration. All right, so this is the response. So the effector organ would be the liver. The response would be an increase in blood glucose. How does this response correspond to the initial stimulus? Okay, it subtracts from it, right? And so this is another nice negative feedback loop. All right, and if that doesn't bring blood glucose back to the set point, then that glucagon signal is going to tell the liver, well, chop off another molecule and another and another and another until blood glucose gets back to where it should be. Okay, so in the normal individual, is blood glucose absolutely flat constant? No, it goes up and down depending on our sleep and what kind of things we're eating, but it is maintained in a healthy individual via homeostasis so that it changes just what? A little bit. What about insulin and glucagon? Are they secreted absolutely constant, flat? No, they're going up and down. And why are they going up and down? To compensate for the going up and down of glucose. So the way that I think about homeostasis is that it's a dance of parameters. It's just not a constant flat line, right? It's a dance where these different parameters are going up and down, but not just glucose and hormone levels, but blood pressure, temperature, pH, everything is always moving up and down, compensating for other little changes that are taking place in your body. Okay? So it's kind of an advanced concept. But everything in this class you should always appreciate and think of in terms of homeostasis, because that's how your body maintains a healthy state. Mostly through the use of what kind of feedback mechanisms? Negative feedback mechanisms. Okay. All right, so that's it for this particular chapter. So let's see, we start at 11:30. We go to 12:50. Okay, got it. All right, so here is a sign-in sheet for today. So pass this around, sign in, please. Okay, and then the last person, bring it down to the front of the class, or just pass it back down to the front. Okay, anybody have any questions on homeostasis? No? Okay. Next chapter. Ah, it's a fun chapter. Okay, it's chemistry. All right, so don't forget, if you're having trouble finding these PowerPoints, try not to just open it up within that frame in Blackboard, but actually download it. Use that right-hand mouse button, save target as, save it to your computer, and then print it out from there. And you can print it out if you have the PowerPoint program with 4 pictures per page. If you want to print it out 1 picture per page, that's fine, but that's a kind of expensive, especially if you're printing in color, right? So you can say print it as a handout and then select 4 PowerPoint pictures per page, right? 6 is probably too many, it's too small for you to really appreciate. Okay. All right, so chemistry. This is what we're going to talk about in this chapter, something about atoms. What the heck are atoms? And then what is an element? And then how do we make molecules through different kinds of chemical bonds? So we're going to talk about some chemical bonds. We got to cover acids and bases. We got to figure out what an acid is and what a base is, where it comes from. And then we're going to talk about some organic molecules. Actually, these are important biological molecules. We'll define what an organic molecule is and talk about these different kinds of biological molecules here. All right, so that's what we're going to look at in this chapter. All right, so an atom. An atom is one of the smallest forms of matter. And matter is just anything that can occupy space. So like this table right here is made out of matter. It has atoms because it's occupying space. But even the gas that's in this room is matter. It's made out of atoms. Right? And atoms can take different kinds of forms. They can be different kinds of elements. And we can see the different kinds of elements over here on this, what we call, periodic table. All right? And the elements have names. They're not spelled out on this periodic table because they wouldn't fit. They have chemical symbols or abbreviations for them. For instance, this first one right here, we symbolize with H. H stands for hydrogen. People in the front can see that. Okay? So there's a list of elements that I want you to know, and it's in one of your slides, about six slides up. Okay? You don't have to know this whole periodic table, but there might be about 10 of these elements that you have to know their scientific symbol for and their English word for that for whatever it is. So we have hydrogen here, H. Sodium is Na, because the Na doesn't come from English. It comes from Greek. And sodium in Greek is natrium, so that's why it's Na. And potassium is important in our bodies. Potassium is a K, and you might wonder, why is that? Because K is not English. It stands for kalium in Greek. Right? So different. So there's not a nice correspondence. A lot of times it's real easy to see. For instance, calcium is Ca. That's really easy. Carbon is C. That's really easy to say. But what about iron? Who can, anybody know anything about iron? What's the abbreviation for iron? Is it I? It's Fe? That's strange. Okay, but you're right. Iron is Fe. Here's iron. All right, but there's another biologically important element, and that is I right here. And what's that for? Iodine, right? So don't be fooled by that. I have the list that you can follow in the next couple of slides up over here. There's not too many of them. Okay. Well, what makes these different elements different from each other? In order to appreciate that, we have to understand something about an atom. Okay? And an atom has a number of subatomic particles that make it up. So we're going to dissect an atom. All right, there are three kinds of particles that can be an atom. There is something called a proton, there's something called a neutron, and an electron. Some of these particles have an electrical charge, an electronic charge on them. The protons have a positive charge, electrons have a negative charge. And it's the exact magnitude just opposite each other. It's the exact same electrical charge just opposite to each other. So a proton has a charge of plus one, and an electron has a charge of exactly minus one, not 1.1 or 1.001 or anything like that, exactly one, right? So these are exactly opposite each other. That's amazing, whoever figured that out. I don't know who made it that way, but that's the way it is. The other kind of particle is this neutron right here. And a neutron has absolutely no charge associated with whatsoever. We're not going to talk much about neutrons in here, but we're going to talk a little bit about protons and electrons. And the way that atoms are put together, at least for this class, is based on a model that you can think of our solar system. So we'll call it the solar system model. So think of our sun and the planets of our solar system. Who knows of another planet besides us in our solar system? Like Mars, Jupiter, Venus, okay? What can you tell me about the Earth and all these other planets with respect to the sun? What are they doing? They're surrounding the sun. They're in an orbit around the sun, right? They're rotating around the sun. Okay, well, let's picture an atom as being the same kind of object where there's something in the center. We don't call it a sun. We call this the nucleus of an atom. All right, and inside the nucleus of an atom, we can have two kinds of particles that we see here. We can either have a proton or a neutron, but we don't have electrons inside the nucleus, only neutrons and protons. All right, where we find electrons are in orbits around the nucleus. Right, so this particle right here we see in orbit around the nucleus, that's what has to be, what, the leftover particle, which is an electron. That's where electrons are. Okay. All right, so now let me tell you, or let me ask you, what's the difference between, say, hydrogen and carbon? Or what's the difference between iron and iodine? What makes them different elements? Okay, that's a pretty good thing, but I'm going to start a little bit different spot. What makes these elements different are the number of protons inside the nucleus. Okay, that's all the difference is. So, for instance, hydrogen has one proton inside the nucleus, and helium, which is not important for biology unless you're at a birthday party, has two protons inside the nucleus. So that's what makes those elements different, just the number of protons inside the nucleus. Okay, and carbon. Carbon has how many protons inside the nucleus? It's got six, right? So carbon is a lot different than hydrogen. All right, and then in order to make this atom neutral in terms of its electrical charges, if hydrogen has one proton, how many electrons should it have? It should have one, right? One electron. So one proton, one electron makes this atom right here neutral. And that's a very stable state to be in. Something else about electrical charges is sort of interesting, and that is opposite charges attract each other. So a proton and an electron will attract to each other, but particles that have the same charge will repel each other. Two protons will try to force themselves apart. Okay. And you might say, well, how do we get all these protons inside the nucleus? If they like to repel each other, how is it in nature that all these protons can get along inside the nucleus? And this is probably all I'm going to say about neutrons, and that's the job of a neutron. Okay, the job of a neutron is to be inside the nucleus right here and separate these protons out with sufficient space so that the nucleus just doesn't break apart and fly apart. And indeed, sometimes that happens. We call that radioactivity. Right? There are some radioactive compounds where the nucleus of an atom actually breaks apart and emits particles. So that's just the job of the neutron. It's not important for physiological understandings. All right, so on this slide, what you should know is that an atom has two locations, the nucleus, and it also has orbitals. Another name for orbitals are shells. And you can see that for hydrogen, there's only one shell. For this carbon, we actually see that it has two shells associated, or two orbitals associated with it. Okay, and that the difference between different elements is the number of protons that are inside the nucleus. All right, so sometimes physiology is just like anatomy in the sense that anatomy will use the same name, but it will have different meanings. Like, for instance, the word sinus. What can sinus mean in anatomy? It could be like a nasal sinus, your nasal cavity, but it could also mean paranasal sinus, which is what? Big cavities inside your frontal bone or maxillary bone or ethmoid bone. A nucleus could also mean what in terms of your brain? There could be a location of gray matter, right? An accumulation of gray matter deep inside your brain is called a nucleus, like the basal nuclei, right? So, so another name for nucleus or another meaning for nucleus is this spot inside of an atom. What's another name that you could use for nucleus in terms of a cell? You ever use nucleus in terms of labeling things inside a cell? Yeah, there's a nucleus inside the cell. What does it do for us? We're going to see, I think, maybe in the next chapter. It holds our chromosomes, right? So nucleus has all different kinds of meanings. But in terms of atomic theory, the nucleus is where we find what? Protons and neutrons in the center of an atom. Okay. All right, so we give different names, or we give a name to the number of protons that are inside a nucleus. We call that the atomic number. All right, so atomic number is the number of protons inside the atom. And what does that determine? What does the atomic number determine? It determines what element it is. Okay? All right, so you have to know a little bit about this periodic table right here. Okay? So you see this H, that stands for hydrogen, and you also see another number over here. What number do you see?
One.
And what does that correspond to? Okay. The number of protons. Yep, the number of protons inside the nucleus. And what do we call the number of protons inside the nucleus of an atom? That is the, that's the atomic number right there. So this number is the atomic number, which determines what kind of element this is. One is hydrogen, three is, can anybody see that little? Lithium, right? And then 11 is sodium. All right, so on a test, I might ask you, what's the atomic number of carbon? And guess what? You don't have to memorize this because I'm going to give you a periodic table, but I'm going to erase off the English words right here, so the only thing you have to know is how to use the periodic table and the chemical symbol. So what's the chemical symbol for carbon? That's not a tricky one, so I probably won't use that one on a test. I'll use a tricky one. All right, so you look for carbon here because you know the symbol, and then there's the atomic number, which is 6, and what does that really mean? That really means what? 6 protons inside the nucleus, right? So everybody should get those questions right, as long as you know the chemical symbols for various kinds of elements. Atomic mass, I'm not so concerned about. The atomic mass is just the number of protons plus neutrons together inside of a nucleus. That's not so important in our class. But atomic number pretty much is. Because the number of protons inside the nucleus will determine what? In order to maintain neutrality, electrical charge of an atom, it will determine the number of electrons that have to be where? In orbitals around the atom. Okay. So that's the importance of the atomic number. All right, so got to make sure you know atomic particles, where they're found in an atom. Electrons in orbitals, protons in the nucleus, and then atomic number. Electron shells or orbitals, they go by the same name, are in layers around the nucleus. The number of shells or the number of these orbitals is determined by the atomic number. The first shell, let's go back, how many electrons can we put in the first shell? Okay. This one right here, I see one, but on this one down over here, I see two. All right, so the maximum number is not one, it's actually two. The first shell can only have two electrons. And then if there are going to be more electrons around this element, they can't be in the first shell, they have to go into the second shell. Okay. Now the second shell over here on this diagram, certainly you see that it can take four electrons, but the maximum number is eight. On this shell right here. So the first shell is 2, the second one is 8. But carbon doesn't need 8 electrons to be neutral, it only needs 6, right? So 1, 2 in the first shell, and then the remaining 4 in the second shell, and then carbon will be electrically neutral as a result of that. Okay. Okay, the second shell can contain electrons. Oh, you don't have to worry about this last statement over here. All right, so here is another concept, and that is the outermost shell. We call that the valence shell. It contains valence electrons, right? And it is these electrons that give elements or atoms chemical properties. It allows for chemistry to take place. So chemistry really doesn't have much to do with protons inside the nucleus. It has to do with the electrons that are in these orbitals. But what determines electrons in orbitals is the number of protons that are inside the nucleus, which is what kind of element it is. Right? But we're mostly going to be interested in these electrons. So I can see why you say electrons all the time, because that's really chemistry when you talk about electrons. And these electrons participate in chemical reactions by forming chemical bonds. So we're going to learn something about chemical bonds. You know, isotopes, maybe I should have just deleted this from, I'm not going to ask you about isotopes, but you might have, for instance, hydrogen. This is easy. Hydrogen. So here's hydrogen. Here is a hydrogen. And that's just a proton inside the nucleus. Here's an electron in an orbital. We can put a neutron, right, with no charge inside the nucleus of this hydrogen. Does that make this not a hydrogen anymore? Does this make it helium? No, because it still only has one proton. But it's different than if it wasn't there. So we would call this an isotope, and this is what we would call deuterium. Okay? So there can be different isotopes of elements. They behave a little bit differently, but that's not so important for our discussions. Okay? That might be used for maybe medical imaging or something where we need some kind of radioactivity to image something. Okay. So here is an important table for you to know the major elements in your body. So you got oxygen all the way down through magnesium, the corresponding chemical symbol for each of these elements, plus these down over here. So you got to know column 1 and 2. You don't have to know column number 3, but it's interesting to look at. And this table is not in your book. All right, so but this is where I define what elements you have to know for the test on this particular table. And if you can't get that out of your computer, make sure you get a hard copy of it for me, because this table is not in your book, okay? Okay. So you need column 1 and 2. So zinc is easy, manganese is easy, iron and iodine are hard. Look at this one right here, cobalt. Really strange kind of metal. We need a little bit in our body. That's abbreviated CO, but don't forget, CO is not copper. What's the chemical symbol for copper? Is CU. Yeah, so you got to be familiar with these things. And on the test, I could ask you, what's the atomic number for copper? And I'll give you the periodic table, and you just have to look it up and you can tell me, right? Okay. Okay, so chemical bonds. How do we make chemical bonds? You're going to learn about three major kinds of chemical bonds in here, and they form by different reasons. They have different strengths. So if we want to put a couple atoms together to form a molecule and we want it to be a very stable kind of bond, we're going to use a strong one. We're going to use a strong bond. If we're going to put a couple molecules together, but if your body wants to be able to take those molecules apart and put them back together again and then pull them apart again and then put them back together whenever it wants to, you think you need a nice strong bond or a weak bond? A weaker bond. That's right. So your body uses different kinds of bonds for different purposes depending on if it should be long-lasting or if it just should hold things together for a little while. Okay. So let's start with the strongest kind of bond. But first, molecules formed by chemical bonds between the valence electrons of atoms, right? It's that outer shell. Right, the number of bonds is determined by the number of electrons that are needed to complete the outermost shell. So let me tell you what the heck that means. Let me go back all the way to this one. Okay. So the first shell, how many electrons can go in that first shell?
Two.
That's right. This atom right here would be more stable if this shell was completely filled with electrons. Right, or completely devoid of electrons. So it either needs to gain one or lose one to become even more stable. But that's going to change the electrical charge on this atom. That's just the way it goes. Carbon, okay, we see the inner shell is filled up. That's nice and stable. But this valence shell right here has got four electrons. And in order for this carbon atom to become very stable, it needs to either get rid of these four or to add four to this outer shell, right? So the first shell is 2, the second shell and third shell is going to be 8. So chemical bonds are going to relate to these electrons, okay, maybe sharing or jumping from one molecule or atom to another. All right, so what do we have here? We have, this is just a single proton. What is that? That's hydrogen, right? You can look at the periodic table, but you probably know that already. And a hydrogen atom all by itself has how many electrons? It has one in this first shell, but how many does it really want to have in this outer shell? It really wants to have two, and then it's all filled up. So it's going to be looking for somebody all over the universe that wants to give it an electron or share an electron with it. And it's going to bump into another hydrogen atom. And what does this hydrogen atom want to do? It's willing maybe to share its electron as long as it can find another partner that wants to share an electron in this particular orbital. So these two hydrogen atoms can form a nice covalent bond where these electrons are shared between these two different atoms. And these two electrons can go over here sometimes, or these two electrons can go over here sometimes, being shared completely between these two nuclei, making this a fairly stable molecule. So this atom feels like it has its outermost shell filled up with two electrons, and this one feels the same way. It feels like it's filled up with electrons as well. Okay? So this is what we call a covalent bond, when two atoms will share electrons. And since two electrons are being shared between these two different atoms, we just call this a single bond. So a single bond requires two electrons to be shared between two atoms. And this is a relatively strong bond. This is also what we call a nonpolar bond. These electrons, these two electrons, can be found over here just as often as they can be found over here. You're going to see the difference between a polar and a nonpolar bond in just a second. Okay, they're shared equally. All right, so if you're going to say covalent bond, what can you tell me about the electrons?
They're sharing.
Covalent bonds result from sharing of electrons. That's a key word. So underline sharing. Is that on this? Yeah, here, shared. Underline this right here. Okay, shared. Let's look at another slide. All right, I tell you what. Let's work with orbital theory just a little bit. Okay, let's build a water molecule. Who could build a water molecule using orbital theory? Because that would be really intimidating. Could you kind of figure that out? Well, where would you start? Okay, you have to find first the number of protons. All right, let's start with oxygen because that's right in the middle of the molecule. How many protons does oxygen have? Okay, it's got eight. So here is eight. There are eight protons inside the nucleus. Here's the first orbital. How many electrons in this first orbital?
Two.
Okay, how many electrons do we have left over? We got six left over, so they got to go in the next orbital right here. So let's just say 1, 2, 3, 4, and maybe 5 and 6. But how many electrons should be in this last orbital to make oxygen nice and stable? 8, but it's only got 6. So it's going to look for 2 more. All right. Can you think of an atom that is willing to share an electron? Hydrogen can, right? And so in order for oxygen to share electrons with hydrogen atoms, how many does it need? It needs 2. So what's the formula for water? H2O, that you're really familiar with. All right, so let's draw in. Here is a hydrogen, and it's willing to share one. Let's make this one that it's sharing. And then another hydrogen over here. Oh, we just put a 1 right here with its electron. So now this oxygen has its outer shell all filled up, the hydrogen has its outer shell all filled up, and we have a nice stable molecule right here, which is what we call water. Okay? Okay, water is what we call a polar molecule. And we saw in this case right here that this covalent bond between two hydrogen atoms is nonpolar. These electrons that are being shared could go anywhere with equal time all over the molecule. But this water molecule is a little bit different because oxygen has a tendency to attract electrons. And when it's attracting electrons, and electrons don't end up over on this side of the hydrogen atoms, over here and over here. All right, so if we look at water, what are the number of protons in this water molecule? How many protons do we have in this water molecule? We've got 8 plus 2, that's 10. How many electrons do we have? 10. And if we add 10 protons and 10 electrons, what's the overall charge of this water molecule? It's going to be 0. Okay? This is true if you're looking at this water molecule, say, from the back of the room. It's going to be electrically neutral. But if you walk up on this water molecule from this direction, like this, and all the electrons are around the oxygen, what do you see first? You see this proton inside this hydrogen atom. So if you look at a water molecule very close from this angle right here, this one angle, it looks like it's a little bit plus, has a little bit of a plus charge. Overall, it's neutral, but right there, it looks a little bit plus. What happens if you walk up on a water molecule from this direction? What do you see? Neutral? You see all these electrons, so it looks a little bit negative. What about if you walk up on a water molecule over here? It looks a little bit positive. All right, so water molecule electrically overall is neutral, but this molecule is polar, okay, because of the electronegativity of all these protons right here. This end is a little bit negative, this end is a little bit positive, right? So we call water a polar molecule. So oxygen produces what we call polar covalent bonds. It's a polar covalent bond. There are other elements that produce polar covalent bonds, and that is nitrogen and phosphorus. So oxygen, nitrogen, and phosphorus have a strong pull on all of those electrons, and it produces polarity. Even though the whole molecule doesn't have a charge on it, right, it still has little areas of polarity. Okay, well, what does that mean? Can I erase this? Do you see how that water molecule got put together? Pretty easy. Okay. All right, so let me just draw another water molecule. I'm going to draw it a lot smaller. So here is oxygen with some polar covalent bonds. So this end of the molecule is what? By the oxygen right here. It's a little bit what? It's a little bit negative. And this end by this hydrogen is a little bit positive. Same on this end over here. All right, well, let's put another water molecule in the beaker except besides this one right here. So let's put two in there instead of just one. Kind of a hard thing to think of, but just two little molecules. What can you tell me about these electrical charges? Like charges do what, and opposite charges do what? Like charges repel each other, opposite charges attract. Well, so if we put two water molecules in a body, how are they going to exist with each other? Opposite charges are going to attract. So can we put another, would another water molecule go in here like this? No, because these things are going to repel each other. So when there's more than one water molecule, this is what's going to happen. Right? Okay, so this end of the oxygen end of one molecule, water molecule, is going to attract the proton end of the next molecule, and it's going to form a little structure. It's, water orders itself because of these little electrical charges. So water is very ordered by itself. And a lot of times you could think of water as being a liquid crystal. It's still liquid, but it has still a lot of order within it. Okay, what this slide here shows you, what are, where you find these little areas of positivity or negativity, but this slide also shows that water can break apart, can dissociate. We call that dissociation. And when water breaks apart, right, the electron from this hydrogen atom stays with the OH group. Right, so this right here is now a hydrogen atom that is missing an electron. So it has a plus one charge. And so here is a hydrogen atom. Here's the nucleus. Here's the electron inside that nucleus. Well, what do we call this thing if we take its electron away? What is this? That's just a plain old proton sitting right there, right? So, and this is abbreviated H+. Sometimes H+ is called a proton, and sometimes it's called a hydrogen ion. Exactly the same thing, right? So an ion is a molecule that has an electrical charge on it. People use these terms interchangeably, proton and hydrogen ion. And when the electron from this hydrogen, from this proton or hydrogen ion gets donated to the OH group, where did it go? Right here. We call this the hydroxyl ion or hydroxide anion. Okay? So this electron ended up over here. Okay. We're going to come back to that in just a little bit. All right. So covalent bonds are the strongest kind of bonds. The next strongest kind, or a little bit weaker, is called an ionic bond. Let's see how ionic bonds develop. All right, but before we talk about ionic bonds, what the heck is an ion again? Can anybody tell me what a... It's a molecule or an atom that has an electrical charge. Okay, there's an imbalance between the number of protons and electrons that it has. It has more of one than the other. Okay. All right, but again, since this is chemistry, we're still talking about valence electrons, which is the outermost shell. And let's see how an ion is formed. Let's look at this one right here. We see 11 protons inside the nucleus. How are we going to find out what the name of that element is? What's the name of that element that has 11 protons inside the nucleus? What would you use? The periodic table. And you just look for number 11. Where is 11? Here is 12. Too far. Here's 11. Right here. Okay, which is sodium. So here we have a sodium atom. So when sodium's neutral, how many electrons does it have? It's got 11 electrons, right? 11 protons and 11 electrons. Oops, let's go back. So how do we fill these up in terms of shells? The first shell has got 2. The next shell has got 8. 8 plus 2 is 10, which means how many are left over? You got 1 left over. That's got to go to the next shell. Here is the valence shell. Here is one measly little electron, very lonely in this last shell. So sodium is not very stable because, well, what should be in this last shell right here? The outermost shell should have 8 or 0, right? Which means then the next inner shell would have 8 and it would be stable. So sodium is looking over the whole universe to find somebody that wants to accept this electron right here. It wants to get rid of it. So is it ever going to find an element that will do that? And the answer is yeah. And the answer is right here, an element that has 17 protons inside the nucleus. Who is that? That's chlorine, right? If you look at your periodic table, that's chlorine. So it's going to have 17 electrons. So here's 2 in the first shell. There's 8 in the second shell. That's 10. And that means what? There's 7 left over. The remaining 7 are put in the last shell. And for chlorine to become stable, what does it want to do? It wants to get another electron from somebody. Who can it get it from?
Sodium.
Very willing to do that. So this electron will hop from sodium to chloride. They both will become stable. But now let's look at the electrical charge of sodium. If it loses an electron, what's the overall electrical charge of sodium? It becomes positive, plus 1, because it's losing that electron. All right. And what about the overall charge on this chlorine? If it gains an electron, it's going to be negative 1 now, right? So here you have sodium with a plus 1 charge and a chloride ion with a minus 1 charge. Their valence shell is complete. Both of these are completely filled up. They're nice and stable. All right. Furthermore, what could you tell me about these two atoms that have an opposite charge on them? Are they going to repel or attract? They're going to attract each other because they have an opposite charge. So sodium chloride is a fairly stable compound, but an ionic bond is so weak that when you put sodium chloride, that's a crystal in water, it's just going to break that bond, and sodium and chloride are going to go into solution. So they're going to be sodium ions and chloride ions just floating in the water as a result of that. All right, so can you see how these ions are formed based on this orbital theory? And an ionic bond is a very weak kind of bond. But we have to learn how to talk about these ions because there can be different kinds. Here you see two different kinds of ions. Here's a positive one. Here's a negative one. Positive ions we call cations. Negative ions we call anions. And my organic chemistry teacher did this kind of nightmare diagram for me one time, and I've never forgotten it. All right, so here we have, what do we got? We got a cat looking at you, just like that. All right, so cation is what? Positive. An anion has negative charges on it. Furthermore, an ion could have one plus, it could also have two pluses, or it could be three pluses. The same thing for anions. It could be a minus one, or a minus two, or minus three. So that's different than just a plus or minus one. So if you say mono, what does that mean?
One.
You can have a monovalent cation. You can have a monovalent anion. And it's only going to be one charge. Is it a plus one or a minus one charge? You can be di. What does di mean?
Two.
Divalent cation would be what? would be a plus two ion, like magnesium and calcium, all right, are a plus two. So they're a divalent cation. And tri, what does tri mean? Three. So if it's plus three, that's a, and if it's, yeah, plus three, that's a trivalent cation. If it's minus three, that would be a trivalent anion. So that's how you use that terminology. I could probably ask you that on the test. Could give you a list of ions, and then I would ask you which one is the bivalent cation, and what would you look for? Two cat eyes, right. I might have a diagram of the cat on the test. Okay. It would be plus two. So if these are your answers for a divalent cation, right, what would you pick? A, B, C, D, or E? You would pick D, right? Okay. So because in medicine, we have to balance out concentrations, and we also have to balance out electrical charges. And now you can see that we have a lot of ions in our body which have electrical charges on them, which means our bodies are, in their very basic nature, very electrical. We're very electrical beings. And that's something that kind of escapes us until we start to study a physiology class like this. We don't think of electricity inside of our bodies necessarily, unless you bang your elbow and you actually feel that electricity. All right, so next time we're going to start with, we got to finish up on ionic bonds. We'll finish up ionic bonds next.